Hi, it's Mike. It's Saturday. It's the Saturday show where we do one from the vault and one from the week. And earlier this week, in fact, as early in the week as the gist goes, I did a spiel, and it was about my ongoing discontent with the Trump administration's, I'll call it overreach, but excesses on DEI, which was, or the DEI regime was itself in many cases an excess. So it's a pendulum going so far left and so far right, and the pendulum becomes a scythe, and we all get decapitated. But as part of that spiel, my rabble-rousing claim towards moderation, I did mention, you know, I was even against defunding the police pretty much the moment I heard it or the moment I looked into it, and that was June 5th, 2020. And I went back and listened, and it turns out I was totally wrong. No, it turns out, I think, even on June 5th, so George Floyd's killed May 25th, the police stations in Minneapolis burned down, I'm using the passive voice, are burnt down on the 28th. Defund the police starts getting said a lot in chants the next few days. I was very early saying, what are we doing here? And I went back and listened. And so I said, why not visit that torture upon you? No, why not play it for you on this Saturday show when we do one from the vaults? So, well, I'm not going to say enjoy, but please do listen. Maya Wiley, my guest, served as counsel to the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio. She worked for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund for the ACLU. She is a professor at the New School. Hello. Thanks for coming on, Maya.
Hi, Mike. It's nice to be with you.
So actually, I want to start with an institution that I didn't use in your ID and your identification, but I'm very interested in it. And it's the Civilian Complaint Review Board. You served as head of the Civilian Complaint Review Board. From what I understand, you were asked to do so by Mayor de Blasio, who you had been serving as counsel. I just want to know about this institution and how much teeth it has and what it can do. So let's just start with, can you give us a little bit of a history and what power does the Civilian Complaint Review Board actually have?
I absolutely can, and it was a privilege to lead the CCRB. The first and most important thing to know, I think, about the CCRB's history in this moment is that it was demonstrations and advocates like we're seeing mobilizing today who mobilized and demanded the creation of the New York City Civilian Complaints Review Board. In other words, it was a response to concerns about policing, police abuse, and a demand for police oversight from residents, from activists, from civil libertarians and civil rights lawyers that created it. It was a hard-fought battle to create. It required a coalition. It required a lot of hard work. It required battling in words only and in rhetoric and in argument, police unions who did not want to see civilian oversight. It is also not unique to the country. There's civilian oversight. Last count I saw was 200, but New York City's is one of the oldest and is certainly one of the largest, and it does have some powers that are unique to it compared to some other cities. It's civilian oversight, first of all. What that means is it is essentially run and controlled by a board of directors. It is a city agency. It is a public entity. It serves the public and is funded by the city, but it operates independently. You cannot be on the board unless you are a civilian. That means the mayor has a certain number of appointees, city council members have a certain number of appointees, and the police commissioner can appoint three people, usually former police officers, and should, rightly. The whole point is to have the voice and experience of police officers also participating on the board.
And to interrupt, when you were on the board, I'm going to assume that they were actually valuable voices at times.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that's important about how the board operates, it is an investigative body. That means the staff of the agency itself has over 100 investigators. We have the power under the charter of the City of New York to receive complaints from anyone, whether a resident or a visitor to the city, who believes they have been a victim of misconduct. That does not include all things. Like, corruption would go to the Internal Affairs Bureau of the police department. We don't hear corruption cases, but we do hear excessive force being obviously the one in the top of the news, various forms of abuse of power, and even disrespect. If a police officer curses out someone, drops the F-bomb, which we've heard a lot in these protests, that's actually something that can be disciplined. And those complaints as well come to the Civilian Complaint Review Board. We have investigators who then investigate the complaints. We have a relationship with the police department where they're required to help us find and identify police officers if the person doesn't know who they are. Which sometimes happens. You have a run-in with a police officer, but you don't have a name or a badge number. And the police department helps track down and try to identify who those police officers might be. But the decision-making, the review of the evidence, happens at the board level. So investigators investigate, they present the board with their review and recommendation based on the evidence, but the board itself makes the decision about whether or not we can say that there was a violation. And if we find a violation, we send it over to the police commissioner with our recommendation of discipline. And we make public the data about how many complaints, what kinds of complaints, and how often the police commissioner agrees with the discipline. Here's the thing, and here's what a lot of advocates are concerned about. We can't require the police commissioner to take disciplinary action. We can only recommend it and make transparent, you know, how often we recommended it and how often the police commissioner complies. Sometimes a commissioner will discipline, and in fact, often will discipline when we say there should be discipline, but will not necessarily agree with us on what kind of discipline. Because discipline can be anything from take vacation days, send the person to go get more training. And obviously, in the most serious cases like Eric Garner, which I chaired our review of investigation and the vote to send over charges, the most serious thing we can say to a police commissioner is these require charges. That means it goes to an administrative judge who sits in the police department and there is a trial, an actual trial with attorneys, like a court of law, that determines then, and the administrative law judge determines whether charges are appropriate and there's sufficient evidence, as in Pantaleo, Officer Pantaleo, who was responsible for the killing of Eric Garner, and then sends that up to the police commissioner. And it is a unique power to our civilian oversight that we have prosecutors. We have a prosecutorial unit in our civilian agency, and when it is charges, when there's going to be a trial, it is civilian prosecutors, meaning not police department staff, because they also have their own lawyers. It is our lawyers who go in and represent the people, represent the complainants in that trial. And that's what happened in the Eric Garner case. So we have some powers that just expanded, and I think they're important to note right now. There was just a ballot initiative that expanded the authority of the Civilian Complaint Review Board to now charge police officers with lying, because a significant problem that we found were there were times where we may not have substantiated the case, had enough evidence to say whether or not the police officer did wrong, but there was evidence that the police officer was not telling the truth about what happened. Now there's the power to make that its own charge of misconduct.
Right. So I want to just convey to the listeners what the actual statistics are, and it's changed over time. So before you got there, WNYC did an investigation, and they found that the CCRB recommended charges in 175 cases, discipline in 70, and instructions, which is another level, in 12. Of the 175 cases in which the CCRB recommended an officer be charged, the NYPD only sought charges in 7, and the officers received no discipline in 76. So 100 were disciplined, 76 weren't. Now, that was from 2012. After you became involved, all of those numbers went up. But still, maybe you remember the exact percentage or close to, of the recommended charges, how many were actually listened to and carried through?
Yeah, our numbers went up substantially, and I think that was a testament to two things that I want to note. In the previous administration, with a police commissioner, Ray Kelly, who I will politely say was less than receptive to oversight of misconduct. It had, looking at it from the public perspective, there was no question that there was a breakdown in how it was supposed to work. There was just a lot of tension between the two agencies. Because there was a commitment to reform, when I became the chair, true, there was obviously a lot of tension for the public with some of the news stories coming out before I got there about our previous chair. But the short answer was there was a lot of effort to make the relationship work the way it was supposed to and to take police misconduct more seriously. So we did see an increase, and a pretty dramatic one. And I don't remember the exact statistics, but I think we got up into the 80% agreement that there should be discipline. I think the other issue becomes the extent to which there's an agreement on what the discipline should be. Now, there was also a new training protocol under the de Blasio administration to train, much more intentionally train police officers for de-escalation, to do what I think is very important, which is to say, we have to make sure police officers don't escalate. That's one of the problems that we've been seeing with demonstrations, is we have seen police who have engaged in escalating as opposed to de-escalating tensions with people who are protesting. That training is very important, and one of the things I think is going to be useful and important moving forward is that there be more transparency about how and to the extent the training is working. Because one of the things you're always trying to figure out when you're on the civilian oversight side is what's really going to change things in terms of how the police department operates. In other words, you want police officers to do what is right and how they police. So, you know, getting more transparency into whether the training is working, so that is it appropriate to send officers and recommend training, or is it much more important to recommend something that is more disciplinary, like suspension or losing vacation days or all the way up to termination? Termination's a little easier for us because that's usually excessive force cases where, you know, like in Eric Garner, it's pretty plain to us, or was to us.
Right. I mean, it's easier, but of course more harrowing because they're real horrible victims on the other end. So one question I have is, when we hear that, and this is true, that the officer who killed George Floyd was brought up on 17 different disciplinary cases, which could be civilian, which could be internal, and got actual punishment or a letter in his file in one of them, that doesn't mean much, because just looking at the New York civilian complaint board, sometimes, depending on who the mayor is and who the police commissioner is, it's a pretty ineffective mechanism. And other times, with different people who are in charge, ultimately in charge, it can be a much more effective mechanism. You're not as expert on what the board is like in Minneapolis, but it's very hard to draw conclusions when you hear statistics like that, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, I think the public is right to be extremely upset that you hear a police officer received a large number of complaints. Put aside what happens in the individual complaints themselves, but that police officer should be off the streets. If there are that many complaints, you should be putting that officer behind a desk and considering what's going on with that officer. In other words, there should be a risk management process that says, we got a problem here. Because one of the things that we have to talk about honestly more, and one of the things I heard all the time, both from advocates and from residents and communities, because when I was chair, we took board meetings out directly into the community so that we had an opportunity to invite the precinct commander into our meeting and invite community leaders as well as any resident who wanted to come to get up and tell us what was going on with policing in their community. So in other words, not just talking about complaints we had received, but really asking the question, what's working here, what's not? So we had more context for our work, and we're using our ability of civilian oversight and having a relationship with the police department to create more dialogue. The good news was we were hearing that communities, generally speaking, liked the community policing officers, you know, the officers trained and responsible for being the community liaisons, that that was something that was working better. That's a good thing. But that there were a lot of police officers who weren't part of the community policing unit who were not, and that there were instances in which people were saying, we're afraid to file complaints. Our neighbors are telling us they're afraid to file complaints because the police officers know who they are and where they live. They're concerned about retribution. And when you're in a low-income community, when you're in a public housing project, which has its own, it has police that are assigned specifically with its own command to public housing, where there's no question that there are crime concerns and residents want police protection from crime, but also feel that they're treated as if they're the criminals when they're the ones asking for protection, and yet don't feel comfortable complaining because the police officers know who they are, because they're policing their units, they're policing inside their buildings, they're policing their playgrounds. That's a distrust issue, and I am not weighing in on whether they are right or wrong, because it's not a question of right or wrong. The fact that they feel that distrust, the fact that they feel that they can't complain, means that we know the complaints we receive are not all the complaints we should receive. But that means another thing, that the police also receive complaints that the civilian side, we don't have any data. We don't about the complaints they receive that we do not, unless they send the complaint right to us. That means there are two different bodies of data on who is complaining and what they're complaining about that we don't, as a city, have transparency into in New York that would tell us, well, wait. But this is the critical point, I think, is a transformative demand, is that the police departments make publicly available. And one thing Minneapolis does do, and this was a reform after previous police killing that made big news in Minneapolis, I believe it was in 2016 or 2015, is they created an open data government portal. So you can literally, anyone can go in and put in the name of the officer. You can go and put in the name of Derek Chauvin, and it will pull up his disciplinary history back to when they started making that available, which is not his entire history because he was on the force for a long time. But at least that's a level of transparency most cities don't have. And we don't have in New York City.
Quick question, which is, in New York City, some police departments have this requirement. Are police officers required to say their name and badge number to anyone who asks?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I was so concerned about was that we are hearing reports from demonstrators, by the way, including my own daughter, who was at a demonstration and said, Mom, they're covering their badges. I'm hearing they're covering them. It looks to me as I walk down the street that they're covering. That's a violation of police protocol of the rules. And if a police officer refuses to allow their identification, name and badge number, which they have publicly available on their uniforms, that in and of itself is a complainable offense that the Civilian Complaint Review Board can receive.
So here's the broader question I have. During these protests and as people reflect on George Floyd and all the other killings at the hands of the police and examples of brutality, there is a sentiment, and maybe it's informed by rage, it certainly is, that we can't work in any way with the system we have. We have to disassemble this root and branch and start anew. And on the other hand, you have this institution like the CCRB that, when empowered, seems like it can do things, but when not empowered, seems like it can't. When you were running it, did you say to yourself, this can and should be a useful tool in the ultimate solution in a perfect world? Or did you say a fully empowered CCRB is the best we can ask for under these circumstances where the police are so funded and where there's a culture of disaccountability? So it's fine, but if I had to start anew, we wouldn't even need a CCRB, or the mechanism of the CCRB would not even exist as it does.
You know, this is an extremely important conversation that we're having as a nation, as a city, and I deeply embrace this conversation. I have many thoughts. One is civilian oversight, and particularly the expansion of powers of civilian oversight, are absolutely an important tool. And there are some things that are unique to our CCRB that I think are critically important for civilian oversight across the country. As I said, the independence of prosecution of charges. By the way, That's not codified. That's a memorandum of understanding. That could be codified so that a police commissioner can't just tell you, I know I said you could, but I'm not going to in this case. So there are things that can strengthen the effectiveness of civilian oversight, absolutely, as we have seen some expansion of that in our own city. The thing is, there's never just one solution. I would say that there are critical steps we have to take to reassess and reimagine what policing is and what it is for. What we have to do is have policies and leadership, including leadership in police departments, that say our job is to solve problems. And this is not something new. And there have been pilots in police departments in different countries and in the U.S. with some very promising data, but we've never talked about taking it to scale. And that's problem-oriented policing. So if you take Eric Garner, here's a guy who is dead because the police say he was selling untaxed cigarettes on the street. So he's dead because he's poor. He's dead because we don't have a safety net that ensured that he could pay his bills through the end of the month. He is dead because shop owners were complaining who were selling tax cigarettes that people were selling them untaxed on the street. The police response from a policing perspective is crackdown, roundup, arrest.
Mm-hmm.
For a low-level, nonviolent, essentially poverty infraction, a tax infraction. And what a problem-oriented approach would be, okay, we see a pattern. There's a pattern because in this particular place, there are a lot of people selling a lot of stuff, and they're not supposed to. And store owners are upset. What is a police response to that, which in this instance, in a problem-oriented policing instance, would be, is there a different location? Is there a conversation about pulling in other agencies, service agencies, both local and non-governmental and governmental, that can provide an actual solution to the problem that is creating selling loose cigarettes on the street? I think, and I'm speaking right now in the immediate term, in what we can do right now is transparency. The police department and police leadership should be saying, you know what? Public trust is a problem for our ability to do the job, and we must demonstrate that we see that we need to change. And the first step we're going to do as a down payment on the change that we recognize we need to make, in addition to recognizing it's good for us when public services and prevention are supported with public dollars, is that we're going to recognize that we have to show the public where the complaints are, what the complaints are, how we're handling them. And part of the cone of silence is also about whether police feel that they will get sufficient protection from their colleagues if they speak out. And that requires leadership, the leadership of police departments, whether it's the head of the precinct, the chief of detectives, all the way up to the police commissioner, to say, we are going to identify and see problems, and we're going to intervene at leadership level. We're not going to leave it to rank-and-file police officers to police their own alone. One of the third thing I will say, in addition to the peace dividend, in addition to the transparency and accountability, is we have to have police commissioners who will drive the change. If we do not have police commissioners who see and hold this vision, it is very hard to change departments. But you have to recognize that you can do it differently. And we need police leadership that says, we're going to do this differently.
Maya Wiley is a university professor at the New School. She was legal counsel to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. She's a commentator on MSNBC, where you see her all the time. Thanks so much, Maya.
Thank you, Mike. It was great to be with you.
And now the spiel. When Donald Trump says something, sometimes he means it. Sometimes he doesn't know what he's talking about. Sometimes he's flat out lying. Sometimes it's just bluster. And sometimes there really is strategic ambiguity at play. Not just the retroactive excuse that, no, he wasn't lying. There was strategic ambiguity at play. But of all his policies, the one he was most honest, forthright, and direct about just might have been his vow to undo DEI root and branch. How would he do this? The answer is, we know now, totally and without any moderation. So on this program, The Gist, I have done segment after segment over the years about claims of discrimination and racism, and segments about discrimination and racism, many segments on DEI. A year ago, I hosted what was called DEI Week on the show, and then one of my guests was Northwestern School of Education's Ahmad Brown, who is a scholar in diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice. He acknowledged that there's a lot of evidence, some compiled by his mentor, that shows that DEI, as it's currently implemented, just doesn't work. He talked about an example of a car company where many employees had grown tired of DEI and initiatives.
It's not just white men, for example, who are saying, I'm feeling fatigue. It's sometimes your black employees, right? And there are different reasons sometimes, but, you know, there are some black employees, some, you know, people with, you know, what I might say, what I call typically in my academic work, minoritized identities, where it's like, yeah, you know, I appreciate we have this DEI initiative. I appreciate that we're caring, but you know what? I kind of want to come here to make cars, and I'm tired.
Ahmad Brown still very much believes in DEI. In fact, he has given his life to it. But there are clearly elements of DEI that are not working. He's honest enough to admit them. I saw my job over the years as pointing out the parts that do work and the parts that don't, especially if the dysfunctional elements are being inaccurately hailed as successes. That has always driven me crazy, no matter what sector of society we're in. My principle is, on DEI, everything else, to be a fair broker, to be intellectually consistent, that's very important, and to try to lead my audience, you, to think about the issues critically and factually. So, in this way, I was one of the first people in non-conservative media to point out that calls for defunding the police were awful rhetoric and worse policy. It's June 5th, 2020, I did a spiel about that. Then I did a spiel about the time the African American Museum posted information that defined, quote, white dominant culture or whiteness to include hard work, self-reliance, and respect for authority. The Washington Post headline on what happened next was African American Museum site removes whiteness chart after criticism from Trump Jr. and conservative media. Well, I criticized it too because I'm intellectually consistent. I'm not scared if someone wants to call me a conservative, even though I'm not. This was just a dumb idea. It was backwards. It was a damaging idea. I think it was wrong for the Smithsonian to advocate it. I said so. A lot of listeners didn't like that. Then we get to police shootings, which I've done many, many, many segments on. Roland Fryer and others have found that black people are no more likely to be shot by a white cop than people of other races. But they also found, and I reported it, they are more likely to be physically abused. I also talked to many, many different scholars who got into the nuances of the issue, the non-fatal physical abuse that young black men face by cops, and also the fact that black women are more often verbally abused by cops. And that's according to a guy named Rashawn Ray, a sociologist who had a lab at the University of Maryland where he did virtual simulations. I've done dozens and dozens of stories about racism, sometimes saying this accusation of racism was overblown, many times saying, wow, this is really bad. I did segments on the exclusion of black jurors in southern courts, which was statistically significant. I did many stories on the black-white wealth gap. And my point is, I didn't and don't consider my analysis of race and DEI as conservative or liberal or moderate. It's just fact-based. It's just driven by evidence. I want to give you the evidence. And I point out often, sometimes to the consternation of listeners, I don't want to dwell on that, but every time, for instance, I talked about that Smithsonian Museum, I got so many letters and emails saying, why are you focusing on this? And isn't there something to be said? And aren't you joining with the wrong side or making a big deal out of nothing? And, you know, I just go where my interest in the facts take me. I would say more often than not, the people who listen or have continued listening appreciate that. You know, as a thesis, diversity and inclusion, they really are worthy goals. But the way that corporations and colleges implement strategies and rules to achieve diversity and inclusion, often illogical, often counterproductive, if what you really care about is diversity and inclusion. If it doesn't work, don't you want to know that? Then came the Trump administration, and they swept it all away. And after they used that broom, They got out the dustbuster, and after that, the vacuum, and then basically the gasoline and the match. So we had the worst air disaster in the U.S. in two decades. And what was the lead?
As federal investigators hunt for answers in the deadly plane crash over the Potomac River, President Trump shifts to blaming diversity policies, air traffic controllers, and his political rivals.
I put safety first. Obama, Biden, and the Democrats put policy first.
We can only accept the best and the brightest.
The era of DEI is gone at the Defense Department.
The This Week panel segment this week on ABC was entirely given over to the question of whether Donald Trump should have blamed DEI.
Thanks. Let's get more on this now from former DNC chair Donna Brazile, former RNC chair and Trump White House chief of staff Ryan Priebus. Thank you both for joining us this morning. Donna, let me begin with you. That call from President Trump blaming the crash perhaps on diversity initiatives was echoed by other members of his cabinet. Your reaction?
Well, as you well know, George.
Now, the Gist also covered Trump's blaming of DEI hires. I focused on Trump laying the blame at the feet or foot of certain groups.
Hearing, vision, missing extremities, partial paralysis, complete paralysis, epilepsy, severe intellectual disability, psychiatric disability, and dwarfism all qualify.
But of course, this wasn't Trump just being totally idiotic. There is an animal cunning to his methods. He set a sort of trap of blaming DEI, yes, without any evidence, as all the news pointed out. But he's the president. He did have some evidence. Not that DEI had any role in the crash, but he knew that the deceased pilot was, I don't think a DEI hire, but she was Rebecca Loback. She was the co-pilot of the Black Hawk, and she was female, and she had been a White House military social aide in the Biden administration. And that is all Trump needed. He knew what he was doing, and his base, his immoderate, unreasonable base on the issue, his not guided by evidence base, as I've always tried to be, they'll love this story. They'll feel justified. And they are feeling justified now when they hear blowback that was almost guaranteed to result from his stupid application of an anti-DEI explanation for a plane crash. Here was Van Latham on the Higher Learning podcast.
And we say that DEI is the new N-word.
Yeah.
It's not the new N-word. It's worse than the N-word.
Yeah, sure it is. That's why Donald Trump says DEI, DEI, DEI at the drop of a hat or a Blackhawk, but there are at best rumors of him once saying the N-word, and they're secreted away in the vaults of the apprentice's office, kept under guard, under the assumption that even with all of Trump's transgressions, that would be an utterance too far. Because those two initials, or those three letters versus that one letter, of course, they're the same thing now. I can't say that I'm surprised that the Trump administration would interpret the public sentiment that pro-DEI initiatives have gone too far, that they'd interpret that to mean, now we got to roll things back to 1965. Now we got to report on our co-workers. Now we got to blame DEI like McCarthy once blamed communists, or like the Taliban blames infidels. I also wish that I could say that what the Trump administration is doing is a strategic mistake. Right. To the extent that the president had a mandate, it was only to correct excesses, not to substitute fact-free pro-DEI assertions with free-floating anti-DEI blame. But you know what? I can't say that. The American electorate is not exquisitely attuned to all the nuance of what assertions are right and what is wrong, nor can they be expected to be. The presidency, or the bully pulpit portion thereof, is a blunt instrument. It's mostly, I'm with you, and they're with them, and sometimes that's the best they can do. And now a lot of people who liked his DEI stance, it's not even registering to them what he's doing. That would be the explanation, by the way, that I prefer, that reasonable, caring people will recognize that the DEI regime went too far, that things like white privilege and white fragility and whiteness studies started sounding like unfalsifiable criticisms of immutable characteristics, and that the reasonable, caring people began to nod along in recent years and wanted the correction, wanted the pendulum to swing a little bit. But I just am not confident that the reasonable, caring people caucus is big enough to matter. When the opposite of a truly dumb and thoughtless presidential statement which blames diversity for deaths, is countered with blaming anything on DEI is now the same as using the N, sorry, worse than the N-word. What's the reasonable moderate stance on all that? There is a cultural pendulum, and then there's power. And more, I think everything comes down to who could grab power and how they wield it. If I tell you that Christopher Rufo and the authors of the Extreme DEI Reset have overreached and will surely face a correction, I'd say that's probably a fiction that I would use to comfort myself. It's probably more fictional than an accurate prediction of what's to come. To break through, someone has to show how their version of a reasonable application of DEI doesn't put most people on the defensive, doesn't alienate or accuse most people, and actually strikes most people as beneficial, as improving lives. Because that's what we want government programs to do. Not to act as a cudgel wielded by whoever has the power to smack down the last person who wielded that cudgel against their own enemies. And that's it for the show. Corey War is the producer. Michelle Pesca is CBSO. We're going to talk to you Monday.